Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Buddhist Centre podcast with me, Chandra Dasa. I'm delighted today to be in the East End of London at Space Studios with artist, Buddhist artist, Hugh Mendes, also known as Parma Bodhi. Parma Bodhi and I didn't know each other until very recently. We've got many friends in common. I'd heard his name for a couple of decades, and we ran into each other on a retreat in the USA. And that's how we end up here today, to record a conversation, I suppose, about a whole range of things that Parma Bodhi brings to his practice as an artist, his practice as a Buddhist. And we're just delighted to be invited into his studio. We're going to put a whole feature up about this conversation. You'll see lots of lovely little videos of Parma Bodhi, Hugh, at work. But first of all, let's welcome the man himself. Welcome, Parma Bodhi.
Thank you, Chandra Dasa.
What's the light of two names? Which name would you prefer for this conversation?
Well, I think for this, it's Parma Bodhi, really.
Yeah?
I mean, mostly in the art world, I'm known as Hugh Mendes. In the Buddhist world, I'm known as Parma Bodhi. And I think I was saying to you earlier, they've tended to be quite separate, but increasingly they're melded together in my own being and out there in the world. So I quite freely talk about both in both contexts. Like when we're on that retreat you mentioned, I talked about Rembrandt when I was leading some meditation in the evening and so forth. And, you know, when I'm at college, if it's relevant, I'll talk about Buddhist practice and so forth. So I think I'm Parma Bodhi. You know me as Parma Bodhi.
Sure. I'm getting to know you as Hugh Mendes. In a way, this is what this podcast is about. We're interested in stories from people's lives, normal people, to the extent that you're normal, practicing as Buddhists, just living in the world, doing their thing. In this case, you're an artist, you're a working, living, breathing artist. Most of us who are in the order have two names, obviously. Some people do change their names completely and they go by one name, but most of us are used to that thing of surfing between different realms, I suppose, where different names are sometimes appropriate. We're going to hear some more about your life. We're here in your studio, your beautiful studio, surrounded by your work, some of which is from the 70s, much of which is from a recent series called Obituaries, which is now the mainstay of your output. The first thing that I thought when I saw them in real life, as opposed to the pictures you've been sending by email, was just why you choose to paint at all. Like, why painting in the sort of post-environmental art world of 2020s? Why back to painting? Why sometimes oil painting?
I love oil painting. I'm completely obsessed with it, both its history and its contemporary current context. I love the substance of it. I love what you can do with it. It's completely malleable and it has so much nuance and it's highly sophisticated. It's very simple. There's so much to it. After 30 or 40 years of working with oil paint, I'm still exploring and finding out new things about it. And it's been a very long, slow evolving process. Like we said, there's a painting up there from my original degree show, 1978. So from then till now, I'm still using oil paints. And
is the formal aspect of painting part of the attraction? You're in a tradition, lineage.
I build these stretchers, I stretch the linen, prime the linen, nail it onto the canvas in the old traditional model. So I'm referring back to the history of making these objects, oil paintings on canvas. That's very much part of the practice. I love that part of it as well. I like banging in the nails and stretching the canvas. And the whole process of it, I am engaging with that 500-year history of oil painting. Like we've got Van Eyck's oil-painted self-portrait up there, and he was one of the very first people to use oil paint. So I'm very much engaging with that whole thing, and I want it to be pertinent and relevant right now in the 21st century, just as much as ever. There's been a long debate for years and years now. You hear this every now and then, oh, painting's dead. It's never dead. You know, it's as alive now as it ever was. If you look at the auction houses or the galleries or anywhere, you'll see they're full of oil paintings. I teach in an art school. I specialise in teaching oil painting. I was taught by some of the really good painters of the 70s, people like Ewan Uglow, Craig Yatchison, David Hockney. These guys taught me about oil painting and I pass that on to my students and it is endless and it's a beautiful thing to be able to work with it in that way.
One thing that strikes me sitting here, dear listener, how lived in this space feels. I mean, how much time do you spend in this studio? It really feels like
quite a lot of time.
Home or something.
Home from home. You know, it's my working environment and I work a lot. If I'm not here, I'm at college teaching. If I'm not at college, I'm here. So I'm here 3, 4, 5 days a week and I'm here 6, 8, 10 hours a day working. And my active life is largely in here, you know. I have a little flat nearby, which I share with my wife. Lindsay is a nurse and you know we eat there and sleep. and then we go to work.
So you're a working artist in the proper sense of it. This is your job.
I'm an obsessive worker, I'm afraid. A lot of artists are. Keep me awake. I've been very ill for the last 3 years. I had COVID twice, hospitalized twice. As soon as I was able to stand up, I was back here. Back in the studio working.
Back where you belong.
Yeah.
Well, it's great. You can probably hear on the recording the trains roaring past and London life all around.
London fields, yeah. It's very trendy around here.
How do you end up here? So the origin story of your work, and obviously I've heard a little bit of this. I was quite struck listening to another conversation about the German origins of your work in terms of the post-war world of your parents' lives, being born in Germany, and then your first engagement with this work around, I think, 9/11, and the engagement with the world through a second half of the 20th century lens.
Yeah, it was kind of in two stages, I suppose. The first stage, Chelsea Art School in the 70s, and then getting into Buddhism shortly after that. And I think of myself full-time Buddhist, full-time artist, teaches both. But in those days, through the 80s and into the 90s, I was doing a lot more Buddhism. I was teaching and running Buddhist centers here in London and in San Francisco. Spent 7 years in San Francisco. I haven't mentioned about Germany. I was born there because my parents were both there after the war. My dad was worked with British intelligence. My mum was a military nurse. So I was born in Germany, but then we went straight to Canada and lived there for 5 years and came here. Didn't come to this country till I was seven. Lived in Battersea, which was, funnily enough, near where I then went to Chelsea Art School. Anyway, so I had that first phase. And then after my dad died, the late 90s, I was living in San Francisco. That brought me back to London and brought me back to academic world of art and doing a master's at City and Guilds of London Art School, which is where I still teach. So that was sort of second phase. And it was then that I got into all this, working with newspapers, contemporary stories, and then obituaries came sort of from that. And it was while I was at City and Guilds doing my master's that I revisited Germany, found the place where I was born, found out about that place, how it was a Nazi death camp, and then turned into a military hospital after the war. The fact that I was born on Armistice Day in that building was quite sort of a revelation to me and had quite an effect on my practice.
And did that play into the 9/11 stuff? Because I know that was a big point for you.
It was just coincidentally, really, that I was working with these newspaper clippings doing my master's. I was following the story of the election of that year, 2001, where they were recounting the hanging chads in Florida. And I had this clipping that Gore really did win Florida by 104 votes, but they declared George Bush the winner. So fraudulently, he became the president. It's incredible, really. Just imagine if things would have been different. Anyway, so I'd been following that story and I thought, well, what did George Bush win? And I'd found this other newspaper clipping on the street in Brick Lane, an Arabic newspaper. It was a picture of an Arab with a gun, AK-47. I thought, well, I'll put that next to it. I made this diptych so that the gun was just pointing at George Bush's head. I thought, well, that's what he's won. He's won this Arab pointing a gun at him. Put it in my MA show. And the day the show opened was September the 11th, 2001. So that was 9/11. So it was a weird coincidence. And all hell broke out, of course. And so I collected all the newspapers for a week without looking at them. Yeah. All of the newspapers. There was a lot of newspapers. And then I went through them all and found all the images, incredible images, and made 20 paintings and did a show called Into Manhattan's Memory from another newspaper clipping here in London at a gallery called Vault Gallery on Old Street. And that started my sort of real engagement with contemporary politics and stories and the follow-up to 9/11, which was the war on terror, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, assassination of Saddam Hussein. I painted Saddam Hussein's obituary, you know. 2 years later, 2003, I started painting other obituaries.
I'm interested in that because obviously it's quite grim stuff, the politics of both the post-war period and then coming into the modern issues with the US and the Islamic world. Going back to your training, you've got your art school training in Chelsea. I heard you talk with great glee about booking the Sex Pistols at Chelsea Art School. And you go on to set up a Buddhist centre in the Mission District in San Francisco, which is, they're both kind of places associated with particular countercultural, even revolutionary art activity and cultural activity. How does that all work with your Buddhist training? Like, why is art and Buddhism a response to all that, you know, Belsen and 9/11 and...
It's human life, the meaning of life. You know, what are we? Why are we here? What are we doing? What can we do? What are the possibilities? It's also, like you say, counterculture. I was always a counterculturalist, if you like. I didn't want mainstream society. I'd wanted to drop out. I was a bit of a hippie when I was at Chelsea Art School, not a punk, even though I'd built the Sex Prestige. But I was into hippie life. Anyway, being a Buddhist and being an artist were two ways of dropping out of society for me.
Right.
They were alternative versions of how you live. I decided I was going to be an artist when I was six. My dad was into Buddhism. He had Buddhist rupas and books and things. I always knew about Buddhism. I clearly knew that I was a Buddhist shortly after graduating when I was in my early 20s.
Oh.
And they mesh together. They're two sides of a coin. They always have been, and they still are. They're a way of engaging with life. When I looked at Western culture, I thought, well, what's the most meaningful thing? I thought, it's what the best of humans do, whether it's in writing or painting or whatever, music. All those things have always fascinated me and engaged me. And out of all of them, painting was the one that I could do. I mean, I love music and film, and I've got a lot of friends that are musicians and filmmakers and so on. On the other side of it, Buddhism just made perfect sense. You look at human history and you look at the Buddha pops up. There was a guy that changed everything. Like, he was a true revolutionary. Talk about counterculture.
Yeah.
He changed everything. Yeah, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I mean, in a way, that's at the level of ideas, isn't it? I suppose I'm interested in your experience, because we're surrounded by these paintings called obituaries. And obviously impermanence being a key aspect of Buddhist awareness practice, capturing semi-permanently in oil painting records of impermanence, like obituaries themselves.
There's an irony there, isn't there?
Well, there's a tension inherent in it. And I wonder what that's like for you internally. Is there something around trying to attend to holding on and letting go at the same time? Like, how does that jibe with your personal practice of the Dharma and what it is to be a Buddhist in your life?
It's meditation, really.
Right.
It's meditation. It's stillness. There's an ethical element. I think it was actually ethics that first attracted me to Buddhism as such. A clear set of sort of guidelines or principles that made perfect sense and were practical. So there's a practicality about it. It's something that you can do. It's got an immediacy to it. But I think the thing that initially attracted me in a way, or where the meeting point was meditation and drawing, for instance. They are concentration practices. They have an immediacy, a focus. So I took to meditation very naturally, and I took to drawing very naturally. They have something very similar in them. So when I'm here at the studio, like 6 hours or whatever, I'm pretty concentrated. Like, my paintings are very detailed. They're very slow. And so I have to sustain concentration.
Right.
It's not like that for a lot of artists, depending on what kind of art they do, or painters or whatever. When I was on my master's, I'd been trained in life painting, like painting from life models. But after my dad died and I painted his corpse, you know, the life model becomes an object as a corpse. So it becomes a still life. And so I started painting all these still lives as a response to my dad's death and my own mortality. Obviously, Buddhists are interested in mortality, aren't they? And impermanence, like you say. So I was hyper aware of my own mortality.
Yeah,
I was painting these still lives, and the newspaper clippings came into the still life paintings as objects, you know, flat objects on a wall with other objects. You know, all those death images and war and so forth, the representations of death, mortality, impermanence, and so on, as you were saying. And the obituaries in particular, that's exactly what they are. So they function as vanitas still life paintings as much as anything.
Well, it's interesting because there is this traditional Buddhist practice of contemplating impermanence through contemplating the stages of decomposition of a corpse. I'm aware of you describing sitting with your dad's body and painting it as an object.
Yeah.
Presumably in the throes of just absorbing that that's happened, and your dad's very much not an object in a certain way.
Well, you know, I wrote my second dissertation, my MA dissertation, about that, about the corpse, like the exact similarity between a corpse and a living person and the complete difference at the same time.
Yeah.
It struck me after I'd spent some time with my dad's corpse. I walked out of the Marsden Hospital and there were older even than my dad people walking about, animated. And I was struck, what is the difference actually between this corpse and the animated version of that corpse? So it's an existential realism there that I hadn't quite experienced before.
I realised I'd never looked up the meaning of the word obituary.
Ah.
And it literally means to go towards. And I immediately brought up the central idea in Buddhism of going for refuge. Mm-hmm. You experience the sorrows of the world. You experience the limitations of your own mind. You get some glimpse of the possibility of freedom and you want to move towards it. You may not know what it looks like. You may not understand it. But it's almost like you're honed in. And it really struck me that in a way you've gone into this exploration of impermanence and death and mortality by painting these flat, two-dimensional images of quite often other people's images or self-portraits, and where that dovetails with this idea of going for refuge to something, like moving towards something.
Well, when I'm saying I'm spending several hours a day, in a sense, meditating, being concentrated, painting, I'm also contemplating the decomposition of the corpse.
Yeah.
Straight out of the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm contemplating my own mortality. Every painting is a reflection of my own mortality, especially these artists and their self-portraits, how they represented themselves. They're looking at themselves. They're looking at their own mortality when they're doing it. And I'm doing it. I'm engaging it. It's such a weird and complex practice to remake somebody else's self-portrait, and they're staring at themselves and therefore they're staring at me. So I'm painting Kathy Kollowitz here. She's staring at me. I'm fully engaged with her image of herself. You know, she's long dead, so it's got all these different nuances of meaning to it, but it's very much I'm going for refuge. I'm contemplating my own mortality.
There's something, isn't there, when you really take somebody in. I was just sitting there thinking, is she, who's now dead, is she experiencing you as a mirror for herself when you're gazing at her? It's almost like the practice of really taking people in, to some extent, is self-reflection. One of the other connotations of obituary as a word is obviously not just going towards, but going down, particularly down to Hades, to the realm of the dead. Being in the studio is a bit like, there's all the visual aspect, and then you're full of these stories of how this image came about or how that image came about. And it's like listening to you talk about your friends. It's almost like the voices of the dead are everywhere in the room.
Yeah.
And then there's you as a living person around whom all these voices are mediating. You're a medium.
I'm also a living corpse, aren't I? You know, I'm very mortal. I'm very aware of it. Not least because...
You look quite good for a living
corpse.
Well,
not least recently-ish, I was in the ambulance, you know, on the way to the hospital. I didn't know if I would actually get to the hospital. I thought I was going to die in the ambulance. My heart kept stopping and the machine kept referring to me as dead. The ambulance guys were saying, never seen anything like this before. I mean, it felt fine actually to me, but I was very aware of we are very mortal, we're very brief. And it's a bit like rubbing my nose in it all the time and rubbing other people's noses in it. Look, folks, this is your future. You're not necessarily going to have an obituary in the paper, but this is your future.
So you found your subject, the impermanence of self
and other. I mean, we've both referred to the Satipatthana Sutta, which I was going to talk a bit about that anyway, because when I teach Buddhism and meditation, almost all of it comes from that one sutta and has done for quite some years now.
Why is that such a focus for you? I mean, why is that?
It's so simple. It's so direct and simple and all-encompassing. It's like the whole of Buddhist practice for me is in that one sutta. It condenses it all. It's actually quite a long sutta, but most of it is focused on the body.
When you're standing painting, as an embodied experience, is that you inhabiting the sutta in the way?
You could say that.
Inside the practice?
I was going to say that it's physical action, you know, painting. But when I teach meditation, I also say the same thing. It's a physical action.
Right.
Obviously, there's a mental component, emotional component, the rest of it. You know, there's the Satipatthana right there. There are all these aspects, components, but it all happens in the body. Our mind is in the body. Our body's in the mind. You know, it's the same thing in painting and in meditating. So I'll sit at home meditating and I'll cycle through the park, get here. It's all fairly meditative, really. Awareness, mindfulness. It's all there. I love it. I just love it. I love thinking about the Buddha teaching this stuff, sitting amongst the trees.
Is the Buddha kind of an embodied artist in that sense?
Well, I don't know about that, but he embodies the epitome of humanity, I suppose. And an artist at their best touches on that, maybe. I don't know. That's the problem, isn't it? I don't know, do I? I haven't got much of a clue, frankly.
Is that why you teach Buddhism and teach art? Because you're trying to find out. You're trying to learn. Right.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
It is. It's very much that. I was doing that podcast with a student of mine at the college. I was talking about the same thing. If you teach something, you have to keep engaging with it. You have to keep thinking about it. You have to keep reevaluating what it is you're doing. And you have to be open to keep learning stuff. You know, I learn stuff from students a lot. I mean, fascinating things. And if I'm teaching Buddhism, if I'm teaching at the London Buddhist Centre or wherever, I'm having to engage with it like that. I've done a few mornings of Satipatthana. I did part one, then I did part two, and then I'm about to do part three, but they're all actually exactly the same.
Right.
They're just doing it again, but having to think about it again, therefore, and say different things about it and think different things about it. And every painting I do, they're all different. They're all the same, but they're all different. Like all these obituaries, artists, whatever, Benjamin Zephaniah over here, that's from a photograph, but I'm remaking it. We say that, don't we? We remake ourselves from moment to moment. It's the same idea, really. As much as anything, I love meditating and I love painting and I love teaching those things because I love them, you know. It's just a way of engaging with life.
I'm just aware you've gone through different phases. I first heard of you in the context of setting up the San Francisco Buddhist Center with our friend Paramananda.
Yeah.
And I think you were teaching art at the time in California. But I think you said to me when we were talking in the US recently that once you decided to come back, you thought, I'm going to give myself to my art practice. And you basically committed 20 years of your life to turning it into your job, like how you earn your living, how you make your way in the world. And I'm assuming that at some point, Buddhism and art move in relationship to each other in the context of your life, how much time you spend doing them. And I know you're coming back into a role now where you're helping lead retreats and you're doing some teaching at London Buddhist Center. Has it felt just like you're in a transition phase where you're coming back from?
A little bit.
What's
more,
that about?
More Buddhism.
Yeah.
How did that? I kept going back to San Francisco. There was a continuity there after I'd left. Maybe there was about 5 years in the early 2000s when I didn't go back there. But once I'd gone back there and co-led a retreat with Paramananda, we both went back. He left a year after I did. But so a few years later, we both went back and co-led a retreat. And they loved it. You know, there was some continuity there. And every year or two, I'll go back and lead another retreat, work with those people. So I kept that going. I didn't engage with the London Buddhist Center when I moved back to London until relatively recently. I think I bumped into Maitreya Bandhu in the park. He's a guy that I taught to meditate. Like those guys that ran the center for years, Paramabandhu, that whole crew, they all came to the beginners class when I was teaching the beginners class at the LBC. So anyway, he asked me if I could fill in occasionally on lunchtime classes. That's how it started. And I said, well, I'm local. I was living on Roman Road. I still am. Or I'm here in my studio just up the road at Mayor Street. So I said, yeah, you can, you know, last minute filling in. So I started doing that. You know, occasionally they'd just contact me, fill on lunchtime class. Lunchtime class at London Buddhist Center, you can have like 50 people there or more. You know, it's very popular. And I like doing it, you know. I'm doing a 4-week course coming up again on Satipatthana. But it's not studying Satipatthana, it's like being, practicing Satipatthana, what we're going to be doing.
I wanted to ask you actually about education. Would you say you're optimistic about art education these days and the teaching of Buddhism? Because I guess one of the challenges for both is to reach a more diverse set of people, to make art and the Dharma available to a wider range of people from different classes, different financial backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, different gender backgrounds, etc.
Especially wore today my Dr. Ambedkar t-shirt.
You're wearing a hedonist, so you can't see this on the podcast. Maybe we'll take a picture.
Dr. Ambedkar, my great hero. I've got my Dr. Ambedkar ring on.
So, okay, so tell us, some people listening to this won't know who Dr. Ambedkar is.
Everyone should know who Dr. Ambedkar is.
This is Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar, a great hero of the Dharma in India, particularly associated with Triratna through his friendship with Sangharakshita. We'll put some notes in the show notes linking to stuff about Ambedkar, but in a way it's quite extraordinary that he's a hero for you when it comes to teaching the arts and teaching the Dharma.
Oh, especially the Dharma. I knew about Dr. Ambedkar, but I went from America to an ordination retreat where I spent 2 months in India, largely with the Ambedkar community, you might say, the ex-untouchable Buddhists, the Triratna movement over there, the Buddhists of India. And I got to know firsthand about Dr. Ambedkar. And I found myself going around talking to these people about Dr. Ambedkar, because that's what you do when you're in India. You talk about Dr. Ambedkar and the Buddha. That's it. And that's it for me, you know, Dr. Ambedkar and the Buddha. That's what I talk about. When I was in America, I was talking about Dr.
You were? That's right. So tell the listeners about Dr. Ambedkar and the Buddha. Give us your exposition.
It's the same thing, isn't it? They were revolutionaries. They were revolutionaries that had a big effect on a lot of people in their life. So Dr. Ambedkar, he was born an untouchable, therefore he wasn't allowed an education. For instance, he wasn't allowed in the village, he wasn't allowed anything. But he did manage to be educated, and he ended up at Columbia University in New York and the London School of Economics here in London. Went back to India and became the first law minister of India, wrote the Indian constitution, made untouchability illegal, The fact that he did that is the most extraordinary thing. It's unimaginable that somebody from that background would become the first Law Minister of India and write the Indian Constitution. It sends shivers through my spine. It's just unbelievable.
Amazing.
Obviously, the guy's a genius apart from anything else. He was interviewed by the BBC in the 50s, talking about Gandhi and how he fought with Gandhi, and Gandhi went on hunger strike in opposition to Ambedkar. It's fantastic. Everyone's heard about Gandhi, and they haven't heard about Dr. Ambedkar. It's amazing to me. But, you know, he made untouchability illegal in the constitution, didn't make any difference at all. He ended up converting to Buddhism, and his followers went with him. So there was a mass conversion of, you know, he denounced Hinduism, the caste system.
It's specifically that, isn't it? Is that Hinduism has the caste system and Buddhism explicitly does not.
6 weeks after he converted, he was dead.
Yeah.
And Sangharakshita got involved in that story. You could say the rest is history. You know, the Triratna movement in India came straight from that meeting of Sangharakshita and Ambedkar. Well, anyway, so I just love it. I love it for all those reasons. A Buddhist, that really makes a difference on a big scale. And that whatever he did, when it came down to it, the only way he could affect what he wanted to affect was through Buddhism. One could say a lot more about that.
Have you painted Ambedkar?
No.
Have you painted the Buddha much?
No.
No, would you? You working up to it?
I would potentially. I have painted Buddhists. I've painted Sangharakshita a few times. There's one at the London Buddhist Centre. There's one in India somewhere. There's one, I think, in Manchester. And Sangharakshita asked me to paint another dead order member, which I did do, and sent that went to India as well.
It's a well-known there's a poem, isn't there?
Buddhist order member. Anyway, so I've painted a few Buddhists. But when I say about Ambedkar, he immediately comes to mind. Muhammad Ali, human rights activist. Very funny guy, very good at what he did. Went to jail for his principles, his beliefs, gave up his world boxing title. You know, painted him. So, yeah, I haven't painted Dr. Ambedkar. I might do one day.
It's interesting listening to you talk about these different figures. This hadn't occurred to me before about you, and I don't know you so well. Some of these figures are all, in a way you could say this about the Buddha, they're all kind of outsiders who come into relationship with the mainstream. And that was one of the reasons I was interested in us having this conversation and doing the feature on your work, is that your own artwork has started to touch the mainstream. You've had some big exhibitions, you sell to the sorts of places that you wouldn't normally expect a Buddhist artist necessarily to sell to. We've had some fun conversations about the racier end of your artistic life. What's it like to touch those worlds where the values are so different from the sort of internal experience you're exploring when you're making the work and when you're relating to these great figures as exemplars of practice?
You know, the art world is a many-dimensional, varied beast, isn't it? There's good sides of it and bad sides of it. It's a market like any other market. It's corrupt. It epitomizes capitalism. At the same time, you've got political artists and art activists. It's got everything you could think of. And of course, there's always an element of religion, you could say. Look at the history of art in the Western culture. It's religious, isn't it? Most of it. So all of that is part of the art world. The thing that struck me, for instance, I went into mainstream academia, especially when I re-engaged at master's level. But when I started painting obituaries, almost immediately I was having shows. Very good art critics were writing about the obituaries. They caught the imagination of some very good people in the art world. Galleries wanted to show them. Fairly significant collectors wanted to buy them. And very good critics wrote about them, like Edward Lucy Smith, Sue Hubbard, Ben Street, Craig Burnett, all these guys, they've written like catalogue essays for me and stuff. They're really intelligent, very good writers about art. And I've been really, really fortunate to meet these people and to talk to them and for them to write about the work. So it's just happened that what I was doing caught the imagination of some of these people, you know, and people wanted to show them, buy them, own them.
But it's not an accident, is it? Your work is about something that's of such vital relevance to everyone, which is impermanence and death. It's the classic joke about if you want to give a talk on Buddhism and get an audience, you call it sex, death, magic.
Really?
Or something like that. You know, you're touching death quite well, and presumably you're doing it with an authenticity that means people have responded.
Mm.
There's something serious going on in your work with it.
I mean, they say that about art, isn't it? It's just about sex and death. You know, so there it is, Buddhism and art, it's the same thing.
Sex, death and religion. I mean, the context for this conversation, this podcast, is the Triratna Buddhist community. One of its distinctive emphases is a focus on the arts. at least in principle.
Yeah, in principle.
Whether we're very good at doing it in real life is another thing. In a way, that's what we're trying to bring to life with this.
Walk the walk or whatever. And
that's right.
I really tried hard.
Yeah. And Sangar Ashta, who's the founder of our community, wrote a book called The Religion of Art.
Yeah.
Do you relate to art as a religion in that way? I know you've made the comparison.
I didn't like his book.
What didn't you like about it?
I can't remember now. It's a long time ago. But I tell you what, I read David Sylvester about modern art, his essays. They were brilliant. And unfortunately, it was the same time that I read Religion of Art by Sangar Ashta. I just thought it was badly written and I didn't really agree with his principle. I mean, I had a very good relationship with Sangar Ashta. There's a flaw somewhere in saying there's an emphasis on the arts in Sri Ratna, perhaps. I do see it occasionally, the arts well made and promulgated and so forth, but it's fairly rare. So there's some flaw in there somewhere. There's an argument we used to have about if you resolve all your emotional and psychological issues through meditation, we won't make any art, because people make art in order to resolve those things. You know, it's like you slightly shoot yourself in the foot. I don't agree with that either.
But there is joy and play in art as well, even if it's about grief and seriousness.
There can be. I don't know. It's a tricky one. See, I'm still trying to figure it all out. I'm still doing it.
But it functions as your religion, doesn't it, in a certain way? Whether or not you agree with Sangar Ashta's particular thesis, one of the things he's saying is, like Buddhism, the only way art works is if you really live it. Sure. You know, the kind of philosophy as a way of life idea. It's very clear from just being in your studio with you that you live this. Not only are you not a dilettante or somebody who's just dabbling in art, it's like this studio and the beautiful chaos of it and the old Roberts radio on the windowsill and the bits of detritus from your life that you're making something of. It's almost like the whole thing is your canvas or the whole thing is your material. Yeah.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have that, you know, to be able to. I've put a lot of work into it, obviously, but there's a degree of good fortune. I don't understand karma, but I've got some good karma going on somewhere that I've been able to do this, you know. When I was about 6, I had this experience because my mum was imminently going to die. She killed herself rather than dying, but I had this experience that I've been around many, many, many times before, and this time it was going to be different. And it just came to me like that because I became aware of death through my mother. I don't know why I'm saying that, but it's been there all the time, you know, that experience. Obviously, it was nailed into me by my mum's death, but I'd already experienced it before that. I knew it'd been round and round and round. I don't really know about that, but I think we've all been at this for a long time, you know.
Well, certainly as a metaphor, in a way, it echoes back into what you're doing now. You're painting all these testimonies of death, of somebody's life at the same time.
It's a weird thing with painting. It's not like that for all painters, but for me, as soon as I start painting, I've just got to finish it as quick as possible. As soon as I finish it, I've got to start the next one as quick as possible. It's endless.
Well, I was going to say,
it's just meditating.
In your artist,
just keep doing it.
In your artist statement, you say you're in this never-ending series of paintings called obituaries.
Yeah.
But it is going to end one day.
Well, when I'm dead, I've already painted my own obituary.
Have you?
Yeah, it's been bought as well. It's in a collection in London. I did it for a self-portrait. There's the Ruth Borchard collection, which is just self-portraits, and I did it for that. But anyway, it ended up in this other guy's collection, and I did it as an obituary.
Here's an idea. You can have this for free.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe there's a set of stories called the Jataka Tales, which are for the audience. These are stories from the Buddha's past lives, taken literally, where they take the image literally, as different animals, different creatures. Yeah, yeah. I suppose you could paint obituaries for your past if you've really been around many times. I wonder what your past obituaries would have been like. Who was this being?
Well, Rembrandt and all these people. Van Eyck, Gentileschi, I've been all of them. Chardin.
Is that really what it's like for you? You've been all of them?
I'm painting them.
You're inhabiting them. Yeah. Right.
I'm currently engaging with Kathy Conowitz, you know, being her. She's a little sullen, but you get a sense of their personality, their being, you know. Empathy, that's a big part of it, isn't it?
So presumably there's rhythms and currents within even this long-running series now, where the way you're painting obituaries today is not the same as the way you were doing it 10 years ago, or...
No, they were fully photo-based when I started doing them, and they're more often painting-based now, because they're self-portraits, or indeed, portraits of artists by other artists. I've got another sub-category, another sub-series of not the self-portraits, but the portraits. Like I did Frida Kahlo by Diego Rivera, Francis Bacon by Lucian Freud, that kind of thing. It's kind of interesting because, again, it's a slightly different nuance of the same sort of thing.
You've been in this never-ending series of paintings reflecting on impermanence. One day it's going to come to an end with your own death. Has it worked as a practice, the contemplation of the decomposition of the corpse, and how has it changed you in your life?
It has definitely led me to doing more overt Buddhist teaching of exactly that. Like, I did a retreat in California last year on Satipatthana Sutta, and I did six element practice and decomposition of the corpse practice. And again, a few eyebrows were raised, but it meant getting down to the nitty gritty and not skirting around it. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does make sense.
This is real, folks. You know, we're not playing at something here.
Yeah, it's not death as an idea. It's like trying to force yourself in the supportive set of conditions to take on the reality of...
Yeah, do the best you can. It's a precious life, isn't it? I said I felt very fortunate to have this situation here and try and really make the most of it and share that with other people. You know, I mentioned my mother's death and the effect it had on me as a kid, but my much more recent father's death. I had this experience the night before I was going to sleep, and a different person's consciousness came into my consciousness, and I knew I'd never had that experience before. It was an ecstatic presence. Anyway, I got a phone call the next morning saying my dad had died, and I knew straight away, oh, that's him saying goodbye. You hear this sort of thing sometimes from people, but it was a very strong, very real experience, and it was ecstatic. What he was saying to me was, there's nothing to fear in death. That's how I read it. He was ecstatic. He was like a dancing Dakini kind of figure. In fact, I thought it was a female consciousness. So between them, my two parents gave me a lot in those two respects.
I've been in a shrine room with you when you're teaching Satipatthana, and particularly the stages of decomposition of the corpse. And actually, it did come across as, well, maybe ecstatic would be too strong, but there was a sort of delight in you when you were doing it. Like, you did want people to take it on, but it certainly wasn't like being in the presence of something serious.
Yeah,
it was like real, being in the presence of something real.
It's serious, but there's a lightness to it as well, isn't it? You know, one of the things about the Satipatthana, the decomposition of the corpse passage, is that beautiful image of the bones, the colour of conch shells, bleached white. Such a great image. It's so beautiful. But, you know, what he's saying is, that's your bones.
Yeah. I don't know if this is relevant, but you talk in your artist statement about the trompe l'oeil tradition, something looking like one thing but being about another. You're smuggling in, sometimes into something that looks relatively superficial and trivial, you're smuggling in something more serious. When you're looking at these flat canvases and you're painting something that looks just like a representation of a person, what is it brings in the trompe l'oeil element for
you? The trompe l'oeil really is just it looks like a piece of newspaper stuck on the canvas. It's a trick of the eye, trompe l'oeil, trick of the eye.
Yeah.
People, they have that response. They'll see them and they go, oh my God, it's painted. They think it is actually just a piece of newspaper stuck on the canvas.
But inside the flatness, there is a depth.
Especially with the painted images more than the photographic
images.
That's
true. So you want people to plumb down into that experience, so that whether they're shocked by the representation of a newspaper or they're engaged by the person that looks familiar, whether it's Sinead O'Connor or Benjamin Zephaniah or Rembrandt, whoever it is, you are trying to communicate, aren't you? Although you're not being didactic.
I'm just trying to make beautiful objects, really. I try my very best with each and every one of them to do the best I can with it and make a beautiful standalone object. Some collectors buy multiples. Like, there's one guy who's got about 20 of them, but usually they just sell, you know, one thing. So I want that to be like the best thing I've ever made and the most beautiful thing. And like I told you, I made my own fake Rembrandt self-portrait at home so I could live with Rembrandt, so I see him every morning at home, you know. It's
morning, Rembrandt.
Yeah, I do. That's exactly. I come in here, you know, in the morning, Kathy, you know, she's there. But it's a nice thing to live with Rembrandt.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the most awful life. I know I talked about that on that retreat, you know, how Rembrandt was battered by life because all his children died and his two wives died. He lost everything. He went from being very successful to literally losing everything, his house, everything gone, all his family gone. But he still came out standing magnificently, painting those late self-portraits. You know, there's a poignancy there and a depth and humanity, and it's all there in Rembrandt. I talk about Rembrandt, or like I said, I went to the south of France just to look at that painting. It's just the most fantastic thing.
It's a similar quality, isn't it, to the Satipatthana image that you talked about? The bones like bleached conch shells. I mean, I hate to do this to you, but in terms of Sangharakshita's religion of art, beauty is truth, truth is beauty. That's basically his general vibe. So it's very Keatsian.
I would disagree with that.
You're a very Keatsian painter in the end.
I would disagree with that. And, you know, he's talking about the galleries replacing churches, that kind of thing. I agree with all of that, you know. Good for Sangharakshita. He did a lot of very good things.
Well, good for Paramabodhi too. You've done a tremendous amount of good things. It does feel like a privilege, actually, to be surrounded by all this work and for it to be work. I can see your practice in it, and hopefully people listening can hear your practice in it.
Yeah, I hope
Why it matters.
And they'll see some images and stuff. I think I am coming out more and more as a Buddhist and as an artist. It's like out there in the world more. Just the last few years, post-lockdown and all that, it's come out quite strongly, actually. That was when I was like seriously ill and facing death. And since then, it's coming out strong.
It's not just a painting.
No.
You are the work.
Yeah.
In all your beauty and all your truth.
We try our best, don't we?
We do. Well, listen, thank you very much for inviting us as a team into your space and giving it your time. And thanks for talking about your work in probably a slightly more Buddhist-y way. Yeah. I like your coming out as a Buddhist. It's quite good. Maybe we should call this coming out as a Buddhist.
Well, you could do. I don't know. I've always been a Buddhist. It just depends whether I talk about it or how much.
Yeah.
Mostly it's a personal practice.
Yes. Well, thank you for sharing your personal practice. That's what the podcast is about. Stories of people's practice. If you've enjoyed listening to this, there's plenty more episodes, another 450 odd. You can hear lots of stories from Buddhists just like you and not like you. And if you like it, please tell people. There are a billion podcasts. These days, the best way to discover them is through your friends. So yeah, if you like this, tell a friend, get them to listen to Paramabodhi's words and his work. And we'll post a link in the notes. You'll be able to go to the space to view some of Paramabodhi's work in context and watch a film about his life and work, etc. We'll be back with some more stories of Dharma practice soon from Buddhists in the Triana Buddhist community. But for now, please take care of yourself. Please take care of other people. Thanks very much.